for me to see how many sessions there's been on BYU this year at the symposium. I've gone to symposiums here at BYU, I mean at in Salt Lake and also in California for the last few years, and haven't seen as much discussion on what's going on at BYU. And it's interesting for me, having been removed from BYU for 15, 20 years, to see what's going on there now. And it's kind of starting to make me proud of having graduated from BYU. For years, I kind of apologized it or minimized it or just didn't even mention it, unfortunately. But to listen to the students yesterday, to see what's going on, hopefully, I know they're a small minority and compared to the student body at large, but it was heartening for me to hear that there are students trying to affect change at the university. Today, Paul Richards is going to talk to us about more of the political climate there and maybe the history that's gone on there politically at the school. Paul was born in California as of goodly Republican parents, as he says. He obtained his bachelor's degree in journalism from BYU. He has worked as a reporter for several newspapers and as an editor for a group of construction industry magazines. Paul joined BYU staff in 1971 as an editor in university publications, and in 1978 became director of public communications, where he served until taking early retirement in 1992. And when I was there, I wasn't involved at all in the university at large. So even though Paul was there when I was there, I have no recollection of him, unfortunately. But he is currently a freelance writer and researcher who is currently working on the history of early aviation in Utah. And he and his wife, Mary Stovall, reside in Orem. And I'll turn the time over to Paul. And the session ends at 11, so just to let you know.
Thank you, Kathy. We were supposed to have an overhead projector here, and we may get one yet, which I wanted to show Calvin Grondahl's cartoon. If you've seen it, it's in Utah and all that jazz, of a tour going through Salt Lake City and a liberal Democrat rising out of the fountain. And he says, "Watch out, folks, liberal Democrat," and this tour guide is shooting the Democrat a la Disneyland. We may get that yet. Before anyone takes umbrage at this title, and somebody already has this morning, I was partially accosted by somebody who had seen it, Satan's Foot in the Door, Democrats at BYU. Let me explain that it is extrapolated from the following letter that appeared in the Provo Daily Herald last fall. "BYU Students for Clinton," the sign blared at the Salt Lake City airport at Clinton's departure. "Excuse me, is this the same pro-abortion, pro-gay rights, pro-excessive government, pro-immorality Clinton who has endeared himself to so many people with like values? Why would a BYU student support such a man for president? Bill Clinton stomps on every value that the LDS Church and BYU stand for. If abortion, homosexuality, and immorality are on Clinton's agenda, why would a morally upright person want to support him? What also must a teacher or teachers supporting Clinton be teaching students at BYU? BYU should clean house. There are thousands of liberal arts colleges around to take malcontents at BYU. Before Satan gets both feet in the door at BYU, let those on the Lord's side stand up and be counted so that the truth can prevail." Although the letter caused me to wonder about the differences between liberal arts colleges and conservative arts colleges, I dismissed it as just another mindless ad hominem attack so characteristic of politics, political phrase. Then the day after the national elections, I was intrigued by reports of sobbing despair and gloom and doom fatalism on campus. One student was overheard saying he wanted to sign up for an overseas LDS mission so that he wouldn't have to personally witness the fall of the United States. Others didn't understand how God could let the true party lose, except that in these latter days, his prophecies of Armageddon must come to pass. As I sought Clinton supporters to see how they felt, I was referred to those liberal Mormon Democrats. Not just Democrats, but always those liberal Mormon Democrats. I've lost track how many times I was asked if I planned to talk to both of them, and in fact, just yesterday I was asked again if I'd talked to both of them. That's a standard, that and the holding meetings in the local telephone booth for Democrats as opposed to Republicans for the mass meetings. "Yes, I found both of them and many, many more. Indeed, they are in sufficient numbers and in positions of such authority that the author of the letter would undoubtedly conclude Satan not only has both feet in the door, but has long since led BYU carefully down to hell. More than 40 people were interviewed for this paper. Talked to outsiders, students, faculty, administrators, Democrats, independents, and even a few Republicans as insurance for my soul. Outsiders expressed surprise that Democrats even exist, much less hold high administrative positions at the school. I explained that Democrat Robert K. Thomas was appointed by staunch conservative Republican Ernest L. Wilkinson, himself a former Democrat, to serve as the first director of the Honors Program in 1959 and as academic vice president in 1968. Thomas continued in the latter post throughout the 1971-80 presidency of Dallin H. Oaks. Most of the academic vice presidents and many of the associates since then have been Democrats. To their credit, their political affiliation was barely known. Wilkinson, on the other hand, was notorious for using his position as president and quasi-LDS general authority to promote his political ideologies. A 1962 pro-Wilkinson editorial in the Daily Universe in all candor stated, "Most of us who have been around for a while realize that President Wilkinson is a conservative Republican. We know these things because he has told us many times." I'll be skipping, so if this isn't completely in continuity, you'll have to excuse me. I've got more than what I can present here in the time allotted. From 1891, when Mormons were divided equally between the Republican and Democratic parties, until 1951, when Wilkinson became president, politics at BYU, for the most part, quietly followed trends in the state. Back then, BYU was not a big internationally recognized showplace of the church and therefore was not considered a political pry bar. Nor was it assumed, unfortunately, as is now the case, that anything said on campus represented church political views. Although all Democrats I interviewed were willing to talk, a few expressed fear of being quoted. One told me, "There are risks involved. I have to ask myself, should I be interviewed?" Another, citing the current academic freedom rank advancement turmoil on campus, said, "On top of whatever else we are, we can't afford to be publicly Democrat." This was not, by the way, one of the principals in the turmoil. Democrat Alf Pratt, an associate professor of communications, while working out in a BYU gym the day after Bill Clinton's victory, expressed hope for the future. He says, "People around me were shocked. Come on, you're not serious," they said. A few refused to converse further. Afterward, two in the group sidled up to Pratt and admitted they had voted for Clinton, but felt they couldn't tell their colleagues. It was almost like they were closet homosexuals, Pratt laments. Linda Brummett, manager of BYU's general book department, claims there are more Democrats on campus than people realize, but they are, as she says, chicken. They have learned the best way to survive is to never bring it up. In spite of fears, no one I talked to or interviewed knew of anyone who had been denied advancement at BYU as a result of being a Democrat. Actually, it was more dangerous for Republicans than Democrats under Wilkinson, as political scientist Ray Hillam, one of the victims of the infamous 1966-67 student spy ring, attests. He says, "My sin wasn't being a Democrat. It was worse. I was considered a traitor because I was a liberal Republican." Hillam was targeted for a number of reasons, along with five or six others in that aspiring scandal. The highly respected J. Keith Melville, a Democrat and now professor emeritus of political science, fared better under Wilkinson, but not without a scare. Following provisions of the so-called Second Political Manifesto, which requires BYU personnel to get clearance before seeking political office, Melville obtained permission from acting President Earl C. Crockett to run for Congress in the 1966 race. Wilkinson was on leave at the time, running for the U.S. Senate. After suffering a humiliating loss to Frank Moss, Wilkinson returned to find Melville preparing to run. He called the professor to his office and asked who had granted him permission. When Melville explained he indeed had permission, Wilkinson asked how he was going to finance the campaign. Melville replied he would do the best he could and then had the temerity to ask if Wilkinson would like to contribute to his campaign. Wilkinson brought his fist down on his desk and exclaimed he would not contribute 1 cent to that, quote, socialist party. In spite of this and a continued high profile in the Democratic Party, Melville completed a distinguished career at BYU without handicap. He notes, however, that it seemed easier for Republicans than Democrats to get permission to run for office. The closest I came to finding rank advancement interference by Wilkinson, based on possible political leanings, was a story told me in 1985 by the late Martin B. Hickman, a Democrat who served 17 years as social sciences dean. Hickman said a certain Professor X was up for promotion, but Wilkinson wouldn't approve because he didn't like the letters the candidate had written to the Daily Universe. Mystified, the professor said he had never written to the universe, not one letter. The dean so informed Wilkinson. Time passed. One day, a Wilkinson research aide approached the professor in the library, saying he had been searching everywhere for the letters. Might the professor have the originals in his files? Obviously, Wilkinson was still hot on the trail. After realizing he had the wrong man, he approved the advancement of Democrat Thomas G. Alexander, who is now Lemuel Hardison Red, Jr., Professor of Western American History. Alexander made it, but I just wonder what happened to the author of those letters. Sometime later, Wilkinson called History Department Chair Ted Warner to solicit nominations for a committee assignment. Warner's suggestions included Alexander, to which Wilkinson responded, "No, no, not Tom. He's a socialist." Wilkinson later called Warner back, to explain that he didn't feel Alexander was a socialist, but a number of LDS general authorities would think so. Uh-huh. Alexander didn't get the assignment, but considering how faculty feel about committee work, being viewed as a socialist probably was an advantage. It may not have been dangerous to be a Democrat, but the atmosphere was so thick with post-war communist threat paranoia that anyone left of extreme right-wing Republicanism felt marginalized. Merle Tanner White, computer science undergraduate coordinator, says she was shocked when she came to BYU near the end of the Wilkinson era and found a total lack of political diversity. There was one opinion about everything, and if you didn't have it, you weren't part of the system, she recalls. What was worse, she had been viewed as a conservative in New York, but in Utah was labeled an ultra-liberal. It was freaky, she says. And by the way, a number of others expressed the same sentiment. In fact, one who was very active in the Republican Party in Hawaii and a legislative analyst became a Democrat in Utah, and he felt like he hadn't moved over one bit. Bill Evanson joined the physics faculty in 1970. As a Democrat, he was highly offended when Wilkinson brought a prominent Republican speaker to campus and put BYU's imprimatur on what Evanson terms egregious political favoritism. Evanson went to a respected senior faculty member, also a Democrat, and asked, "Do I really want to be at a place like this?" His friend said he too had once considered leaving and he had even secured another position, but got called as a bishop, so he stayed. The friend said he told Harold B. Lee in an interview that he supported church leaders but sometimes couldn't agree with Apostle Ezra Taft Benson's right-wing politics. Lee, one of Benson's strongest critics, said he didn't agree, and not to worry about it. That conversation, together with the arrival of Dallin H. Oakes, who, quote, brought a breath of fresh air to the campus, convinced Evanson to stay. He has since served as an associate academic vice president and is currently dean of physical and mathematical sciences, another Democrat in high places. Martin Hickman said he felt the same. "I think the day Dallin Oaks became president of BYU is probably the greatest day in BYU's history since Mazur opened the door of the first classroom. Dallin turned us around. It may be unfair to say this about Ernie, but Ernie took politics far more seriously than he took anything. Dallin took the church more seriously than he took anything." In his inaugural address, Oakes said, "Brigham Young University has no political objectives, only intellectual and spiritual ones. Our attitude toward matters purely political should be that characterized by Thomas Jefferson, whose first inaugural address counseled that error of opinion may be tolerated where reason is left free to combat it." I like that statement. Error of opinion may be tolerated where reason is left free to combat it. We need a little more of that nowadays. Oakes established the following policy where candidates couldn't run for couldn't use university facilities, mail, privileges, or anything else when running for political office. He counseled people to be careful if they were in high position, such as deans, not to say things that could be viewed as a university endorsement for any particular party. Clearly, this was a radical new direction for BYU. In addition, he called for a moratorium on the use of the terms liberal and conservative on campus. This was in his inaugural address. And he attempted to lessen schisms between the religion faculty and other disciplines. He and his successor, Jeffrey R. Holland, who also was serious about maintaining neutrality on campus, made enemies in the process, not among the faculty in general, but among a small conservative insider clique of religion teachers. Just as insider trading is outlawed on Wall Street, so should insider sycophancy be outlawed in the church. It makes life miserable for BYU presidents. The biggest politically based fiasco of the Oaks years occurred in 1977. It demonstrated that in spite of attempts to be neutral and create an atmosphere where various ideologies could be discussed in a gospel-centered atmosphere, the university was still very much captive to the right-wing politicization that had infected the church since the 1950s. Wayne Hawley, a BYU alum, was chair of the Utah Communist Party. His nephew was a student of Ray Hillam's and wanted to know why, if BYU had academic freedom, Hawley couldn't speak at the university. Hillam, who was chair of the political science department at the time, saw no reason why not. He now admits that this was bad judgment, and made arrangements for Hawley to debate with Keith Melville's American Political Thought class and Lamont Tullis's Political Ideologies class. Unbeknown to the professors, church officials had earlier tried to excommunicate Hawley, but that action had been stopped by Hubie Brown. Melville says he invited Hawley because he had confidence that students could entertain and discuss issues without being propagandized. Tullis, a Republican, had already had a conventional Republican, a conventional Democrat, and Basil Dunn of the John Birch Society speak in his class, and he thought it was appropriate to hear from a communist. Tame little old Wayne Hawley, as Tullis now describes him, was hammered by the students. Tullis says he has learned that one of the best ways to evoke political rationality is to expose students to radicals. I found that it pushes students to the center, that students see the wide-eyed views of extreme right and left as impractical, he says. Probably nothing would have happened had not Hawley, in a subsequent speech at a Salt Lake High School, mentioned that he had spoken at BYU. Word got around, and BYU was called to task. What followed has been described as Black Thursday or Bloody Thursday at BYU. Although the Hawley incident involved only a few political scientists, some 40 faculty from history, economics, and political science, apparently all problem areas, were called to a 10 a.m. meeting Thursday, April 7, 1977, and told that Oakes was their advocate with the board and he would do all he could to further academics at the university. But they couldn't expect to rock the boat until it capsized and then count on being rescued. Oakes said there was a point beyond which he could not be of help to them. 5 days later, Apostle Ezra Taft Benson addressed the student body in a devotional saying, "There is no excuse for any BYU instructor to grant a forum to an avowed communist for the purpose of teaching communism on this campus. It may be done on other campuses in the United States, but it will not be done here." Hickman, recounting the debacle 8 years later, said, "Sometimes we stumble into things. If I'd known who the guy was and all of the ramifications of his visit to the university, I wouldn't have approved it because I knew he would use his visit not simply to inform our students, but to validate his position. Dallin just fought some battles for us. It's incredible to me that anybody could have been that bold and brave." Oakes' bravery most likely cost him his job. He had backed his faculty for merely a decade in resisting pressure from Wilkinson and Salt Lake to hire conservative Richard Vetterly in the political science department. Oakes' hand finally was forced in 1979 when the Board of Trustees directed him to hire Vetterly over the faculty's objections. Oakes was released without explanation in May of that school year. It is interesting that Vetterly, who was thought to be a right-wing plant, went on to gain the respect of his faculty colleagues, produce solid scholarship, and shield the university from certain factions in Salt Lake. But that's another story. Several Democrats and Republicans I interviewed say Oakes' efforts toward political neutrality were well-intentioned but somewhat quixotic. As one says, the Oakes administration can't change the tone, but not the substance much. If Republicans had an advantage earlier, they still did. Newly appointed President Jeffrey R. Holland had to deal with just such an imbalance in October 1980 during the Utah gubernatorial campaign. Utah's First Lady, Norma Matheson, represented her husband Scott in a student-sponsored forum with Republican challenger Bob Wright. Prior to the event, both parties had been sent a letter saying that this was not a debate, but just to present your views. But this was Republican territory. When the student moderator said, "This is not a timid audience, attack the governor," Wright did. When students heckled the first lady and cheered him, Wright played along. Finally, during what was supposed to be a two-minute uninterrupted closing statement by Mrs. Matheson, she was jeered and had to cut her comments short. She left the stage in tears. Later, she said that during the entire campaign, she had never been treated so poorly. It was ugly and painfully embarrassing, not only for BYU, but its sponsoring church. The story appeared in newspapers across the country. Wright overplayed his home court advantage, and Mrs. Matheson, who was not debating, ultimately won the debate as a result of that publicity. Wright's handlers attempting to recoup their losses by issuing a news release a week later, quoting Wright as saying, "The BYU administration has taken the responsibility for the students and issued me an apology for the way I was treated during the debate on the campus last week. The rudeness displayed by a few students was offensive both to Mrs. Matheson and me. I am appreciative to the BYU administration for realizing this and offering me their apology." I am not aware of an apology issued to Wright, but one never knows what kinds of behind-the-scenes conversations might have gone on. In any event, Wright's people probably figured BYU wanted to avoid further public controversy and therefore would not respond to his statement. They were right. All along, BYU felt a public statement from anyone higher than the student officers would imply support from BYU and, by extension, the church, for one side or the other. This unfortunate paralysis resulted in Mrs. Matheson's never receiving an appropriate public apology from BYU. I mean, what would they have done if Wright had won? You see, you can't get yourself into that position. And there was a good chance he would, since the Republican mentality is that Republicans win. But there was cheering among Democrats and some Republicans when Wright lost, and it was the only bright spot for Democrats in an otherwise politically dismal year. The question remained, what would have happened had Democrats employed such tactics? The answer was obvious. The Wright-Matheson imbroglio marked the beginning of a number of events that kept the nine-year Holland administration on edge as it attempted to walk the tightrope of political neutrality. I won't go into some of the details I put in the paper, but one is Bill Evanson resigned when he became director of general education because he couldn't hold a political party. He was head of the Democratic Party in Utah County. Ray Beckham had some of his students in his campaign, and the Democrats complained about that. Some of you may remember it. And then, of course, the Mecham Carnival, which I've got more than 40 clippings in my files from across the nation on BYU turning down Mecham, who wanted to come and speak when he was impeached and was under indictment. The Democrats were coming out of the closet by this time and speaking up more, some quite vociferously. The most visible was Omar Khadr, a Utah-born son of Palestinian Muslim immigrants who came to the United States in 1932. Khadr, a young Omar Sharif lookalike, knew what it meant to be a minority on two counts, one as a Palestinian among Mormons and the other as a Mormon among Palestinians. He has described himself as a spokesperson for most, if not all, Arab, Palestinian, Muslim, Mormon, liberal Democrats. The belief that contention is of the devil is often invoked among Mormons to stifle opposing viewpoints, but Khadr did not fall victim to that silencing technique. His experiences as a minority person taught him the necessity of speaking up, of arguing heatedly. This became obvious at the time of the Wright-Matheson fiasco. Khadr, who was faculty advisor to the College Democrats and an assistant to the Dean of Social Sciences, got into Wright's face as soon as the prayer was over and said, "If Wright thought he could get away with that type of abuse at BYU, he was full of a certain smelly substance." This caused Wright to complain to a church general authority that a BYU professor had used profanity against him. Khadr was made a bishop a short time later. Skipping over here. Through all these things back and forth, it was very difficult, and BYU was caught in a no-win situation. When administrators tried to smooth trouble in one area in these various fiascos, it erupted somewhere else. This was especially hard on a president who desired so much to be friends with everyone. BYU was learning the facts of political life. It's impossible to be squeaky clean. The university's well-intentioned attempts at neutrality became such a wrangle that it made the Wilkinson era look good. At least back then, no one questioned BYU's neutrality. There was none to question. During this time, back earlier in the Hull administration, in October of 82, Nancy Stokater was responsible for a move that significantly boosted Democratic morale at BYU. She is the wife of Omar Cater and was chair of Ted Wilson's Utah County, chair in Utah County for Ted Wilson's bid for the U.S. Senate. And she wrote, or got a list of names together, and said, put a half page ad in the Universe saying, as Utah County campaign, the following private citizens of Utah, exercising our full faculties, acknowledge our intent to vote for Ted Wilson for the U.S. Senate, encourage all our friends to do likewise. I'm not going to name people. I'm going to put up an overhead here, and you can choose. Some of you are familiar with BYU, or we recognize some very prominent professors on that list. Russian professor Tom Rogers, who is now LDS mission president in St. Petersburg, Russia, was one of 83 signers and recalls, "I felt especially fortunate to be aligned with some of the most revered faculty at BYU." Now there was more than just a handful of publicly identified Democrats at the school. This was a star-studded list of top scholars, many of whom held, or later would hold, chair, dean, and vice presidential positions at the university. Hardly a, quote, undesirable element in American society, as Wilkinson is alleged to have said. Though a few of them and a couple of newer faculty who happen to be Democrats have been implicitly accused of being an undesirable element in BYU society. A bright spot on the Democratic horizon, another one, was the 1990 Bill Orton victory over Carl Snow, a BYU administrator who had taken leave to run for third congressional seat being vacated by Nielsen. The Democrats had smugly watched as the Republicans self-destructed in a bitter primary race between Snow and ultra-conservative John Harmer, and then as Harmer people continued to attack Snow in the general election. What was particularly sweet for Democrats was a last-ditch effort by Snow's advisors in Salt Lake City, who, thinking they understood the mindset of Utah County, ran a full-page ad in a local paper pointing to the fact that Orton was single while Snow had a large family. The ad was offensive and backfired. Maybe Republicans weren't so predictable after all. Throughout the Holland years, the university continued to emphasize political neutrality, and the tradition appeared to be continuing under the new president, Rex E. Lee, whose administration published a six-page neutrality statement October 1, 1989. I need to mention that throughout the Holland years, repeated documents were published emphasizing political neutrality, and the church at the time, and still does, was publishing its general statements of political neutrality. The university community was hopeful that their new president would bring a more independent leadership to BYU. He was financially well off, highly successful as an attorney, and had been U.S. Solicitor General in the Reagan administration, where he had argued some 50 cases before the Supreme Court. He had that mystical aura that church-broke bureaucrats stand in awe of. He had been out in the real world. Lee was quick of mind, sometimes refreshingly, sometimes offensively flippant, and thrived on the give and take of a good argument. Above all, he seemed fair, and every man's and every woman's advocate, for he had argued contrasting views in his numerous court cases. And Democrats felt good because he included several of their party in his administration, the academic vice president, several associate vice presidents, and BYU's legal counsel. It came then as a bitter surprise to Democrats and others that he could or would allow the university to be pulled into a highly partisan George Bush political rally in July 1992. It had all the trappings of a political convention, none of an academic forum. BYU people led the cheers, and the crowd acted like it was at a basketball game against the University of Utah. A Salt Lake Tribune editorial described it well. For all their effort to host President Bush in a politically neutral manner, BYU authorities were steamrolled when the politicians descended on them. Mr. Bush, in fact, was a reasonably affable guest. It was the Utah contingent that lacked self-restraint. Implying that Democrats are illiterate, quote, "I was a Democrat until I learned to read and write," unquote, Senator Hatch indulged in a lowbrow sort of wit. And by saying in so many words that the Democrats' 92 president and vice president nominees have never held a real job, Senator Garn also compromised whatever lofty commentary he might have otherwise delivered. Various BYU alumni, faculty, and the state's Democrats, and this is still quoting from the editorial, pronounced themselves scandalized, appalled, or downright angry. Moreover, BYU officials are now awkwardly offering Democrats an equal opportunity to do what? Also issue stultifying insult from the university's premises? Insult was added to injury when Democrat Congressman Bill Orton, who had recently supported Bush legislation, was not invited to the stand. Just as well, it was a circus. In the space of 2 hours, BYU had retrogressed more than two decades. The university had been prostituted by those who have little regard for its educational mission, and the Democrats felt they were in a cruel Twilight Zone time warp. If we had tried to do the same thing at a Clinton rally, there would be a hue and cry so loud we would never hear the end of it, one Democrat now laments. Actually, all the hoopla didn't do the Republicans that much good. Utah County, which is about 80% Republican, gave only 57% of its votes to Bush. Ross Perot garnered 23%. Clinton received 13%, and Bo Greitz got 7%. And not to rub it in, Democrat Bill Orton won a second term in office. Just how many Democrats are there at BYU? It's difficult to determine, but an informal Daily Universe poll conducted in 1992 indicates that 50% of the faculty consider themselves Republican, 28% said they are either independent or not affiliated with any party, and 22% said they are Democrats. That comes to about 300 Democrats among a total of some 1,400 full-time faculty, definitely enough for a foot in the door. If the same percentage holds among BYU's nearly 33,000 full-time students, there would be more than 7,000 Democrats in the student body. The perception among people I interviewed is that the social sciences, fine arts, humanities, biology, agriculture, some of the hard sciences, and honors education, and surprisingly, law and management, School of Management, probably have more Democrats than other disciplines on campus. Maurice Marchant, who is a former chair of the Democratic Party in Utah County and a former faculty member, says he was always amused at the number of Democrats in law because Wilkinson had wanted so much for the school to be conservative so it could save the Constitution. Education, religion, continuing education, and non-academic administrative areas were perceived as being strongly Republican, while engineering, physical education, nursing didn't seem to have any particular earmarks, though most speculated they were Republican. In political science department, where politics is king, Republican Lou Midgley says the split is probably about even, though he's not sure. He points out, however, that the highest profile Democrat at BYU now is exit pollster David Magleby, chair of the department and a regular consultant to BYU's administration. Democrats have also infiltrated the church structure at BYU. Salt Lake Tribune columnists Paul Raleigh and Joanne Jacobson-Wells reported recently that former Democratic gubernatorial candidate Kim Gardner is a president of the BYU Fifth Stake, and he has four others, counselors and clerk and so on, and high counselors in that stake presidency. The columnists wonder if the stake could be accused in Utah County of political heresy. Of course, there are many Democrats in church positions at BYU, but the fact that the above circumstance is newsworthy betrays the public's perception that Democrats are anathema at BYU. Some of the people at that I interviewed said being a Democrat at BYU may be tolerable, but off campus, is in the meeting houses and neighborhoods of Happy Valley, it's another story. Alan Keel tells of Democrats in his neighborhood having to obtain a court injunction against a BYU employee who used to stand on the sidewalk in front of the polls and greet people as they came to vote. He would shake their hands and say something like this: "Now, brother, I hope you realize which is the true party and whatever and what responsibility you have as a church member to vote correctly." I'm sure you know that one party is sanctioned by the church and the other is not. Be sure to vote for the true and inspired party. The court injunction put an end to that. Gary Lambert of the French faculty says when he moved to Orem in 1969, a neighbor said, I just thought I'd let you know that this ward is entirely Republican, and we are really proud of that, that we have 100%. Lambert, an independent, smiled and thought to himself, not anymore. Donald Q. Cannon, Associate Dean of Religious Instruction, or Religious Education, says his daughter came home upset one day when a neighbor verbally abused her for wearing a Clinton button. He demanded to know how she could be a Democrat when her father was a professor at BYU and she had been raised in Orem. Nancy Cater, while serving as chair of the County Democrats, found Provo's July 4th Freedom Festival somewhat paradoxical. This highly touted celebration of Americans' freedoms and Constitution would not allow political candidates to ride in the parade unless they were incumbents. Such regulations were necessary to keep the parade from becoming a political free-for-all, but since most elected officials were Republicans, Republicans got the most exposure. She says Democrats were a minority, and we were being discriminated against. We couldn't change the system because it was Republican-controlled, but fought back by slipping in Democratic candidates to ride with Gunn McKay. Garn Coombs, who is chair of secondary education, has not been shy about speaking up in church, and he tells of instances where people would quote John Birch literature or promote a certain candidate in Sunday school or being on the high council. In fact, he walked out on a high council meeting where one of the high counselors giving a spiritual lesson, the little preambulatory thing before they get to the business of the high council, said that he walked out and because this man was reading from somebody's campaign literature as the spiritual message. He was brought back by the stake president, and such an incident never occurred again. I think if more Democrats would speak up, there wouldn't be so many stories to tell about conservatives who, unchallenged, seem to take for granted that everyone thinks as they do. Actually, there are Democrats who are speaking up. I found them among the students of BYU. It was surprising and inspiring to see how active they are, though small in number, and what they've been able to accomplish. Brian Waterman was prodded into Democratic activity as a freshman when fellow students asked him to hang a Bush quail poster in his window. He declined, saying he wasn't Republican. What are you then, a communist, was the reply. He knew then he had to do something, and as of course you know, he's become an editor of Student Review and has used that position to help balance the thing. Brian Dilley, a senior in political science and a vice president of the College Democrats, was reared in conservative Republican, mostly Mormon town in southern Idaho. He was told by seminary teachers that Democrats are bad, that they could get closer to God if they were conservative, and that you could get closer to God if you were conservative, and that one couldn't be a good member of the church and be a Democrat. It may seem strange, but it was at BYU that he came to realize that he sided more with the Democrats. Dilley says that more than 600 students signed up with the College Democrats last fall, but the problem is keeping them active. Some have been raised as good Mormon Republicans. Some, being raised as good Mormon Republicans, see the club as dissident and an underground organization, and they join to display their youthful rebelliousness. They usually are not serious about politics. They don't have the funds that the Republicans have. They don't have the facilities. So it is a disadvantage to them. But the few who turn out for business meetings between 10 and 20 are a powerhouse in their own right. And they actually get along quite well with the young Republicans and the conservatives on campus. This is a new trend we're seeing among students that we don't see so much among the older generation. Dilley and others I interviewed say as BYU becomes increasingly selective about admissions, the demographics of the student body are shifting. More and more students are coming from outside the Mormon Republican strongholds of Utah, Idaho, and Arizona, and are better educated, less provincial, and more aware of world problems than students generally were in the past. They are more open-minded, they are thinking more for themselves, and they understand the difference between politics and religion. They are more sophisticated and not as willing to buy into the idea that you have to fit a certain political mold to be an active member of the church. The student Democrats are writing newspaper columns, letters to the editor, doing quite a bit in that way. One especially articulate column by Dilly, Sarah Jones, John Radford, and Heather Winder appeared in the off-campus student review before the election last fall, and just a few excerpts. A major roadblock to making informed decisions is the practice of buying into partisan stereotypes. These abound on both sides of the aisle, with the redneck, racist, uneducated, frenzies, patriot Republicans pointing fingers at the pinko commie, bleeding heart, liberal, intellectual Democrats who point back. We can safely speak for all BYU Democrats who have, at one time or another, faced the horrified friend who has just learned we are Democrats. But, they say, how can you possibly be in favor of killing babies? Our answer is that both parties have extremists. Being pro-choice or supporting gay rights is no more a requirement for being a Democrat than is being isolationist or supporting David Duke a requirement for being a Republican. There is room for reason in the center of both parties. The college Democrats have organized and actually gained approval, BYU approval, for a pro-choice, pro-life debate on campus. And they are setting up nonpartisan student seminars this fall for prevention of racism, discrimination, gender bias, and sexual harassment. They also want to sponsor a number of quality political debates on campus. Another sign of emerging political health at BYU is the rise of the conservative edge, a, quote, politically incorrect, unquote, off-campus newspaper founded by student Nick Zukin. He believes BYU should be more liberal in its policies. Quote, BYU puts too much emphasis on suppression of controversy and debate, he says. That doesn't sound to me much like a typical BYU conservative, but his attitude is being expressed by an increasing number of students. Zukin invited the college Democrats to take a full page in each issue of his paper. It's a very conservative paper. And the Democrats, therefore, have the left page, and he has the right page, and his people have the right page. As Zukin explains, we invited the college Democrats to contribute for two reasons. One, there is really no place they can go to engage in debate on the issues other than here, which is a pretty telling statement. The Daily Universe is operated, although it has Democrats on the staff, the faculty advisor is very strongly conservative, which accounts for some of the things that you may be aware of in the types of cartoons, political cartoons and other things that have been done there. Two, we are pretty much convinced that our position on the issues cannot suffer from comparison with theirs. And if it can, then we need to wise up. The forum page is truly a debate. If we lose, we lose. It is a risk we feel we ought to take. That sounds pretty radical. And how do the Democrats feel? And they wrote, the primary reason we feel we should be a part of this paper is that BYU community needs a forum to discuss political matters. BYU begs for a rational forum of discussion. In the absence of such a forum, most political discussion and arguments occur over the cafeteria table and in the halls of the library. In such an environment, arguments are seldom well thought out, and the winner is usually the loudest proponent. Worn-out partisan cliches are sometimes the only tool used to persuade. A friend of mine recently had a conversation with someone who thought BYU was right in trying to rid itself of undesirable faculty because students aren't mature enough to be exposed to diverse issues and ideas. If the above exchange between young conservatives and Democrats is any indicator, it sounds as if the students can handle diversity far better than their elders. Among the people I interviewed, some of the most cogent reasoning in support of strengthening the Democratic influence on the campus and in the community came from Republicans. Hal Miller, Dean of General and Honors Education, is a registered Republican and former Goldwaterite who says he has become more independent with time. I found myself moving away from those who want clear demarcations and battle lines. I am more inclined to resist identifying differences. Miller has situated himself more with those who are slow to condemn, adamant about remaining open, willing to discourse about differences, and striving to see the merits of people and arguments that at first blush seem repugnant. Nominal Republican Dick Paul, former history professor at BYU and Western Illinois University, now retired, says he wishes Utah County had a two-party system. Quote, I believe in the two-party system because only when you have vigorous interaction will you have the best government, he says. Antipathy toward politics because of antipathy toward government is prevalent everywhere, but nowhere more than in Utah County. Poll cites Goethe, nothing is more terrible than to see ignorance in action, and says there is a lot of ignorance on the part of church members in regard to politics. He explains that success-oriented middle-class Mormons put themselves, their families, their jobs, and their church way ahead of their citizenship responsibility. The allegiance to the Constitution is superficial, an emotional, slogan-based, knee-jerk sort of patriotism. And if you've ever seen Provo's July 4th Freedom Festival, you'll know what I'm talking about. Kent Harrison, a professor of physics, is a soft-spoken but powerful advocate for equality and human rights. He is active in the Republican Party. When I referred to the letter about Satan's foot in the door at the beginning of this paper, I could sense his blood pressure rising. Harrison says that type of thoughtless diatribe makes him want to climb the walls. As argument against it, he quotes John Stuart Mill, as cited in this paper. I didn't read it earlier, but that's the quote from John Stuart Mill. He says, "I think it's wonderful and essential that Democrats have a voice at BYU. I am delighted when I see a variety of opposing views at BYU, even though it makes some people uncomfortable. If some get upset, tough. Republicans need to be brought up short once in a while because we don't have all the answers. All parties are groping, and there are good ideas on all sides. I shudder when I hear talk of Republicans talking of creating a veto-proof legislature." Harrison refers to the current furor on campus and says, irrespective of